The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 125, The Love Trust Model, a Behavioral Interpretation of LDS Doctrine for Counselors and Teachers, by C.K. Allen.
Good morning. I'd like to welcome each of you to our session 125, where there are few in number. They say there the Spirit will be, and there are few in number. But I'd certainly like to welcome each and every one of you here this morning. I noticed one of the questions that was asked on the brochure that was sent out to before the final one was, is it possible for a person who has doubts to serve an honorable mission? And I happen to be one of the doubters. And my wife and I served in Romania as a humanitarian service missionaries. And of course, in Romania, as humanitarian service missionaries, we were not allowed to proselyte. We were not allowed to talk about the church. And so I could certainly serve an honorable mission without being excommunicated. And one of the things that I taught when we were in Romania was the love-trust model. Schools for the handicapped, I was talking to one of the psychologists one day, and I says, I feel like that my mission is a failure. I says, because one of the things is that I don't understand the language, and I had an interpreter. And I says, and another thing is I was not able to role play. And so I questioned how much the people got from what we've been doing. And the psychologist, she says, you know, as a result of what you've been teaching us, and we've been teaching concepts from the love-trust model, she says, we now talk to one another, which we never had done before. When a problem comes up, we try to solve problems through the commitment process. We try to establish trust. We try to engage in reflective listening. We level with one another. We're more assertive. And I says, but things haven't changed in terms of your program. That is, in terms of money and resources. She says, no, none of those things have changed. She says, but our attitude toward one another and our attitude toward being able to be of service to others has changed, and that has made all of the difference in the world. And so she says, certainly I don't think that your mission has been a failure. And I think that I can attribute that pretty much to the love-trust model. Our speaker this morning is C.K. Allen. Some years before, I had the opportunity of listening to his son, Roger Allen, and had him at the Wyoming State Hospital where I had worked. And he's the one who first introduced me to the love-trust model. And then I got in contact with C.K. Allen and was telling him that I would like to be able to teach this as a workshop at Western Wyoming Community College out of Rock Springs, Wyoming. I live in Evanston. And that we weren't able to get anything off of the ground at that time, and then we went to Romania. And then since we've returned, this is now a part of the official offering of the Western Wyoming Community College as the Love Trust Model. And I teach this at Evanston. And C.K. Allen at one time lived here in the state of Utah. He served on in a political as what Senate in the Senate, right?
House.
In the House, and was the chair. And he's used the same concepts in which he'll be teaching us here today in that position. He now lives in Denver, Colorado. He has written two or three books. One is Journey from Fear to Love, and which is out here on the desk or table, and it's for $10. And he's also written one on the power of the laws and power of love, and he also has some tapes that are available, which he will talk about here. But at this time, rather than me continuing talking, I would like to present C.K. Allen. If he presents and he talks, you will know him through what he does. Okay, and thank you.
Thank you,
When I was a student in college back in the late 40s and early 50s, I was disappointed to learn after I'd chosen psychology as a major field of study that there was enormous differences between religious people on the one hand who were suspicious of psychology and the psychologists on the other hand who were really quite suspicious of religion. And there seemed to be a natural enmity that bothered me. But it turns out that my deepest interest was in studying people and understanding people. And I was not willing to give up my interest in the church. And I was not willing to give up my interest in psychology and in therapy. And I, in fact, became a therapist. And I'm now a practicing therapist in Denver. It occurred to me, this was some 30 years ago, if you will, that there didn't need to be that kind of enmity. And in studying the 84th and 76th and 132nd sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, it became clear that there are not only 3 degrees of glory sometime in the future, but we're living in those states of being now. And I begin to ask myself, if I'm a telestial person now, that is, if I have telestial attitudes now, what am I like? And the fact of the matter is, as I start thinking, what's it like to live among liars and cheats and worse? The bottom line is, I'm pretty fearful all the time. My attitude towards the world is, the world's not a very good place to be. So I don't trust you, and you don't trust me. And we call that world the fear anxiety world. Fear, anxiety, hostility. And it becomes very, very clear that there's lots of people living their lives from the basic motive of fear. And it exercises itself sometimes in great hostility, and sometimes it simply becomes a fear that's withdrawn and apathetic. There's all kinds of directions that fear can take us in, but they're all pretty unhealthy in the long term. Now, if there's a better state of being for you and I, a better set of attitudes to live in, what is it? If I'm a fair and decent and honorable person, my agreement with about everybody else, including my agreement with the world, changes. And the change is, I'll be fair with you if you'll be fair with me, and that is so much better than I'll get you before you get me that the whole world starts to change. And we call that, it's the terrestrial kind of attitude, and we call it the duty, justice, honor state of being. All this is written about in a book we wrote a number of years ago called The Journey from Fear to Love. And in the back of that book, we've sort of outlined what we see is a sort of a model for the way life unfolds. Some of us get stuck in fear anxiety, get caught in what we call the cycle of weakening behavior. And that is so encroaching and so devastating that by and large we can't get out of fear anxiety without help. For instance, in therapy, here's what usually happens or often happens. Wives usually begin therapy. She says, this the wife, this the husband. She says, I need to tell you what's wrong with him, and please fix him. And he says, when he does come in, and a lot of times he doesn't want to come in, he says, here's what's wrong with my wife, and please fix her. And the blame game starts, and the blame game does years and years of devastation, and he has put the power of his happiness in her control. And she has put the power of her happiness in his control because she says, when he changes, things are going to be fine. And she says the same thing, and both of them have given up personal responsibility. There was no ill intent in this, folks. People don't deliberately set out to learn to fail, but they do learn to fail, and the facts are, in America today, we just saw the latest statistics last month. The divorce rate in the U.S. of A today is running at 60%. Over half the marriages, that is the most intimate relationship most of us have, ends in divorce. We'll talk about a little more of that later. But let me now kind of show you the rest of this model. It's a major awareness when we can move from being entrapped in fear anxiety to a more healthy world of duty justice. But that's only half the story. There's another world out there. It's the world, this is the world of people who go the second mile. These are the people who quit keeping score. These are the people who are celestial in attitude now. I don't say they're perfect. They're not perfect. But they have an attitude that's very enhancing. And we call this higher level, the love, trust, care level of being. My own judgment, I've been pretty active in the church. Unlike Charles, I'm one who've had a lot of doubts and still do and will probably go to my grave, but I've been a bishop, I've been on the Sunday School General Board, I've written manuals for the church, and so on and so on. And the reason I'm here is because, by here I mean still in the church, is because I like the notion of a preexistent. I like the notion of degrees of reward. I like the solid notion of individual responsibility. But we live in different worlds. We live truly in different worlds. Now, the agreement that love, trust people make the world is somewhat different. The agreement we make in love, trust is this. I realize that I'm not complete alone, Virginia. And you probably realize you aren't complete alone. And we need each other. We need programs and we need doctrine and we need processes that help us move out of the grip of selfishness, the grip of total self-interest, into something more socially oriented. And it's love and it's trust. These people want to be understood and loved and cared for. And that's all right. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be loved. I think the deepest need in all of our hearts is to want to be loved. To want to be cared for and want to be understood. Now, aren't you just hungry to be understood by someone? And sometimes feel like no one understands you? But the trouble is, the grip that gets on us, and that's kind of a terrestrial sort of grip, the grip that gets on us is this. You've got to wait for somebody else to do it to you. And if somehow you can make that shift from wanting to be understood to wanting to be understanding, then you take the power to control your happiness and what you do back into your own hands. What a power. What a power that is. So, you and I can make a leap from fear, anxiety, up into duty, justice. We can make another leap up into love, trust. My own belief, after literally teaching thousands of classes, is that here's where most of us are. Upper level fear, anxiety, and lower level duty, justice. But we don't want, we euphemistically call this the cesspool. We don't want what the cesspool offers, so why do so many of us get caught in the cesspool? Our belief is that we face every day a lot of key moments. I believe that we face endless key moments every day. Those are moments of emotional impact where we either make a healthy strengthening decision or we make an unhealthy weakening decision. If we make an unhealthy weakening decision at our key moment, I'll give you a key moment I had last week. I teach a class. I don't like to follow the manual very closely. I like to assume that these high priests have read that stuff 100 times or 1,000 times, so I want to know how it applies to them and how to make it useful. And one of the guys in the class said, secondhand to me, "I sure wish he'd stick with the manual all the time." Now that bugged me. Now, when I'm faced with a key moment like that, my natural reaction is to do the wrong thing. I'm either going, if I'm a fighter by nature, I'll fight. How many of you are fighters? If I'm an ignorer by nature, I'll ignore. How many of you are ignorers? I know you're ignorers. How many of you are runners and know you're runners? There's a lot of ways to fight. There's a lot of ways to ignore, a lot of ways to run. And the trouble is, from every one of them, we get a short-term payoff. We don't do a behavior if we don't get some kind of a payoff. If I get mad, it usually means I get control out of my anger. So the payoff is I get some control, but I do lots of long-term damage to my relationships if I'm a fighter. And there are some fighters who are physical fighters, or there are some fighters who are verbal fighters, some fighters who are sarcastic and mean-spirited, some fighters who are violent. The most common is the verbal fighter. If I'm an ignorer, I usually am into denial, or if I'm a brainy type, I'm into intellectualization. Oh, I can talk forever about anything, but I never feel it, and I never internalize it. Now, so if I'm a runner, there are some kinds of runners who are blamers. I can always find that it's somebody else's fault. I didn't have the right parents or the right teachers or the right church or grew up in the right community. I always got somebody to blame. Or there are some runners who become shamers. Oh, it's all my fault. I'm such a lousy person.
You mean a streaker?
Not a streaker. That's a runner.
Boy, that's a combination of a runner and a fighter. And then there's the kind of a runner who actually gets out. In Colorado, every year, we have about 10,000 men who just leave. They just go. And the state tries to track them down to get support payments out of them. And we've got about 2,000 women in Colorado. They just leave every year. They get out. That's a nice way to run until you get caught. Or your conscience always lives with you. Now, there's another way to run. It's very, very common, and it's insidious. You run into inactivity. That is, you run into apathy. You become deader and deader, and your face goes dead, and your eyes go dead, and you don't want to get involved in anything that's the least bit risky. Now, I've said we get a payoff for all these things. What's the payoff for being a runner? You don't have to face the consequence of facing up to a real issue. There's a real payoff. Or you get to feel sorry for yourself. Or you get to blame somebody. There's lots of payoffs, short-term payoffs. But the long-term consequence is absolutely devastating, because every time we get an improper or hurtful payoff, it diminishes our capacity to act progressively, and our world becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, and pretty soon I become 25% of a man, or 10% of a man, or 1% of a man, and I'm just waiting to die. You see this happening? It's everywhere. So the cycle of weakening behavior becomes tighter and tighter and tighter, and people, by and large, don't know how to get out. What do we do about this? There's plenty. There's plenty we can do about it. But we can't do much until people become aware that it's happening. And aware, here's the danger. When we're in big trouble, we're by and large pretty sure somebody else is causing it. For instance, here's what's happened to me in the last 3 months. Denver's a big city and getting bigger by 75,000 people every year. And our streets are getting clogged. And our drivers are getting worse, and there's a lot of anger being generated out on the highway. And I was becoming a part of that anger. I was people tailgating me, and people pushing in, and people not letting you in, and all this sort of thing. And I was getting home pretty griped every day. Then I had a nice insight. The insight was, I'm letting all these angry people determine how angry I'll be. Am I willing to give them that kind of power? And bring it closer to home. If I go driving with my wife and don't like the way she's driving, what do I do? Tell her what to do. Guess what she does when I tell her what to do? Yeah, she gets angry and she'll do the opposite. So here we are having a fight over the stupidest little things, and I think it's her fault and she thinks it's mine. Easiest cop-out in the world. It's his fault. It's her fault. Now, we get caught in that trap all the time, and that's one of the basic reasons that our divorce rate, even in the church, is now at 50%. Half of our marriages don't work anymore. And a lot of people who stay together, it's not very nice. They don't enjoy it very much. Now, as Charles knows, well, you don't know. Ordinarily, in the classes that we do, we have lots of role-playing. Who's got a problem they want to solve? And we get up here and we work at it, trying to show them some trust-building skills. When you and I make the decision that we don't want to travel this weakening path anymore, it's then that we have a choice about it to do something strengthening. You can make a choice to do something strengthening and to learn to quit doing something weakening. So I went through a process of saying, do I need to be mad at all the drivers in Denver? No. I got to learn how to do that better. And I've learned to do it better. I don't get mad at drivers anymore. You know, you have that power of choice. You don't have to get mad. You don't have to get mad at your wife if she criticizes your driving. You don't have to get mad at your kids if they tell you off. Now, you need to deal with it in a productive way, but you don't have to do what I thought you had to do, and that was always be mad. Because I'm by nature a fighter. My wife, by nature, fights until she's cornered, or runs until she's cornered, and then she fights. Who doesn't, huh? Now, the question is, what do we do? Through the years, we've tried 118 in all of our classes, 118 ways to build awareness, a new awareness, to give you a new way to see. That's what we're doing here today. We're not going to give you any skills. We're going to give you a new way to see. We've now boiled it down to 5 ways to see, to check yourself, to know if you're going to be heading back down for your cesspool or whether you're going to do something healthy and productive. I don't have time to go into what all of those are. If you want to read about it, you can do it. Or if you want to listen to some of the tapes, it's called Beyond Coping Skills That Make Relationships Work. You can do that. Here's what I want to basically center the rest of our time on. There are a series of key, this is a new awareness, and now these are some trust-building skills. And by the way, as far as the church is concerned, in Denver, we have regular sessions where we work with high councils, with state presidencies, with bishoprics, to help them see some new counseling procedures. And some of them learn very quickly. The standard answer of a bishop having trouble with a young couple in his ward is to say, "You're both nice people, go home and pray about it." Well, they are both nice people, and they've been praying about it for years. They need something else. They need some good valuing questions. So one of the things we'll teach a bishop to do is, would you come back, when we have our next meeting, would you come back to the next meeting and write down a list of things you do that weakens the marriage? Don't want to know what your husband does. Want to know what you do. And then we say to the husband, we'd like to have you write down the things you do that weakens the marriage. And what's happening when we do that? We're putting his monkey on him. We got an article of faith about this. Second article of faith. He's responsible for him and she's responsible for her. And the trouble is, she's gotten to blame him and he's gotten to blame her. Doesn't work. So now, if we can start to say, you're responsible for what you do and he's responsible for what he does, then things start to change. Because she comes in with a new way to see, I really do a lot of things that weaken our marriage. And if I keep on doing them, then the valuing question is, does it work? And when you try and use force, it doesn't work. Does it? Who in here wants to be forced? Nobody. But we keep doing again and again and again things that don't work. And so one of the things we've learned is we start asking the what question, we ask the why question, the how question, and we've quit asking the why question. He can come up with 100 reasons why he's right and she's wrong, and vice versa. But if we start asking the what question, what's going to happen if you do the same thing you did last night and you got into that big fight? Well, we're just going to get into a big fight. Do you want a big fight? No. Well, what could you do that won't get you into a big fight? Well, I don't know. And at this point, they're very, very teachable. They want to know something better to do. And so we're talking about some valuing skills. The first trust building skill we teach, it's been around forever, and almost no one knows how to use it. It's called creating safe and trusting conditions are learning how to listen to feelings. Think I'm generalizing too far? Almost everyone knows how to exchange information. Almost everyone, if you say this, they say that. My sister or my wife is here with her sisters today, and I'm sure glad I don't have to be there. Because there's going to be lots and lots and lots of talking. I bought this. Well, I bought this. Well, I did this. My kids did this. And I don't do that anymore. And that isn't to put down to her. She's a wonderful listener for me. But learning to listen is a great, big, giant skill that almost no one has. And the nice thing about it is I do workshops with Mountain Fuel and Public Service Company of Colorado, and they want to know, what do we do with the angry customer? If you start opposing them, just makes them angrier. So you can't, doesn't work. So they don't know, they know what doesn't work. So now we've helped them to learn to listen and to accept their anger. And after you've listened and accepted their anger, guess what? They're not angry anymore. That's one of the reasons that love is so much stronger than hate. If you don't have to resist that force, if you can accept it, and lovingly accept it, because you know where it's coming from, then the anger doesn't continue. Wish we had time to demonstrate some of this. But what I'm saying, you can't continue to be angry if someone really accepts your anger, can you? Can't do it. Now, a second skill we use, it's called the valuing skill. That is, it does three things. It faces us with the consequence of what we produce by the way we act. If Charles and I have trouble, and I begin to sense that it's going to end badly, I need to stop action and say, Charles, we're getting into an argument, and I don't like the way I'm feeling, and then I bet you don't like the way you're feeling either, and I don't want it to end in a fight. I'm not even sure exactly what to do about it, but I'd like to do something better than what we always do. Could we just talk without shouting? Could we talk without blaming? You see, that explores consequences. It places responsibility properly. And it ties into the long-term self-interest, because if Charles and I have a big fight, temporarily he wants to win. And if he wins and I lose, who wins? Neither one of us. We both lose. If I win and he loses, who wins? No one, because trust is broken. We've either got to win together or we've got to lose together. You believe that? It's either win together or lose together. Now, just a side note. For a few years, I was on the National Institute of Mental Health Research Committee, and we took a look at where all the money had been spent in research in mental health. And in the early years, just massive amounts of money used to flow into such things as Freudian dynamic psychology. And now, it's flowing clearly into the sort of thing that we do. We want to deal with people's actions now. We don't deal so much with the why. Why? Because the research was so clear-cut. One of the best researchers around was a guy named Aaron Beck out of the University of Pennsylvania, who developed a therapy called cognitive therapy. And it turns out to be enormously powerful. The kind of therapy that we've developed here in this love trust model, I say it's the bridge. It's the bridge that allows me to be a believing Latter-day Saint and a believing therapist. I've made the marriage. The marriage can work. We don't have to say it's got to be one or the other. Religion answers some great big questions that psychology can't answer. I don't think they can. Therapy gives you some great big how-tos that we don't have very well in religion. In other words, there's a marriage that can take place if you work at it. Ours is one way to think about it. Another trust-building skill is what we call breaking the cycle of hostility or leveling. That is, if I get into a fight with you, let me tell you about an experience I had with a banker about a month ago. I'd gotten into some financial difficulty. I could pay my interest, but I couldn't pay my principal. I went in to see my banker. My banker really got on my case heavily. We don't have late loans. Well, they do have late loans. Now, pretty soon, I reached out to him and kind of touched him on the arm, and I said, just a minute. You can beat up on me because I can't make my payment. But the fact of the matter is, if I can have 3 months of interest, I can start making my payment again. Do you really want that property back? No, we don't want that property back. I have found a way to make that property work, but I need some time. Now, I said, I know you got a problem when big loans show up on deficiency or when big loans show up late. I know that's a problem for you, and I got a problem. I can't pay you. Now, Mr. Banker, can we work it out so both of us can feel all right about it? It took the hostility out of all of his questions, and he began to say, hey, I'm not trying to get on your case. Hey, you're a pretty good guy. Hey, we can work this out. And we did. About 15, 30 minutes later, we had it worked out in a win-win way. In other words, if I take the hard position that I'm right and you're wrong, you're going to take the hard position that you're right and I'm wrong. Are you not? Always. But if I can say, hey, you got a problem? I got a problem. I'm not even sure how to work it out. All I know is I want to work it out, and I really believe you want to work it out too. You see how that draws the hostility out of that situation? Sounds easy. Well, I'm doing it in front of a class. It's not easy at all. But my God, it's powerful. It is so powerful if you can learn to do it. Our time's moving so quickly. One other thing I want to say to you. The other skill, we didn't even know this till about 2 years ago, is the power to let go. And in this book, We don't talk about the power of letting go. But in our work now, we found enormous power in letting go. There's two kinds of letting go. One of them is what we call a human letting go. Like I let go of other drivers controlling my happiness. I've let go of my wife and I having trouble when she's driving and I'm driving. We've let go of that. We just worked it through. We don't have time to demonstrate how we do this. We can just tell you, if you can let it go, you're hanging on to a lot of garbage cans that you don't need. But we always want to blame somebody else and hang on to things that we long since should let go of. Now that's one kind of letting go. It's big, it's powerful, it's important to learn. But there's another kind of letting go. It's the ability to surrender after you've done all you know how to do in an area, in a situation. After you've done all you know how to do, does there come a time when you can surrender and let go to a higher power? In my case, putting it simply, I've had a lot of heart problems the last few years. I've had 2 quadruple bypass surgeries and a carting of St. Joe's Hospital in Denver. I've had 14 heart attacks. And one of them, the last one, destroyed about 70% of my heart. And I went into deep depression. And I've treated people for depression for a long time. And I never really knew what it felt like till I really... And I went through the process with the help of a young woman who had been a member of my ward, a singles ward in Denver, and found the remarkable power of learning to let go and to trust in God. There's a lot of dimensions about that, and we won't have time to talk about them. And I no longer feel the need to ask the why questions. Why me? Why have I had all this trouble? Why? I don't do that anymore. I really don't need to. And somehow, if we can trust that will, sometimes we may not feel perfectly secure about it, but when we can learn to trust that will, then there kind of comes at sometimes a peace. I think what I needed at least, was there were times when I needed comfort, just simply comfort. And I didn't find any other person who could give me that comfort. And there were other times when I found a need for courage. I found every morning when I've hit with these angina attacks, what I want to do is go to bed. And if I go to bed, I know I'm going to have a bad day. And I have to make a conscious choice not to do this. I have to make a conscious choice to do this. And no matter how I feel, go to work. And I'm still carrying a pretty full counseling load, and we're writing some books, and we're doing some teaching. And you can make a choice. The basic choice here in all of this is the choice of how happy you want to be. Most of the time when we go through major illnesses, we have a choice, and it's easy to make the choice to feel sorry for ourselves. And people will fill us with sympathy if we're hungry for sympathy. But all that sympathy does is weaken us and weaken us and weaken us. And love does not ask the question, did I make you feel good? Love asks a far deeper and harsher question. Not harsher, better question.
Love asks the question, in our loving relationship, did we increase our capacity to deal effectively with life and with this world? It doesn't ask the question, did I make you feel good? Easiest thing in the world is to make people feel good. All you got to do is sympathize a little. But that doesn't necessarily bring strength. Now what we need to do is face each other in a kind of an interchange that allows us to grow. And out of these trust-building skills, four of them, comes what we call the bedrock of trust. And that's where we learn to really feel safe and to trust each other and to speak the truth to each other. We don't have to worry that somebody's going to go tattletale on us. We can speak the truth. Do you have a friend like that? Do you have a husband like that, a wife like that? Do you have somebody that's a safe place for you? If you do, and you know what it's like to feel safe, a therapist, for example, one of the first tasks I have is to help them feel safe. And sometimes I do it by listening, and if they're playing games with me, saying this and meaning that, I have to do it by the valuing questions and confronting them with the fact they're saying this, but they really mean this. But sooner or later, if we can build some trust, it's then that we can solve problems. And one of the banner signs that we use, and by and large, most of the work we're doing now is with businesses. The banner sign we use is this: build trust before you try and solve problems. Almost everybody out there is trying to solve problems, but they haven't taken the time and the effort and often don't know how to build trust. If you can take some time to learn how to build trust, then when problems get solved, they stay solved. Because there's so much trust between you that if there's a problem, you say so and you work it through. But you say so without blaming, and then you can work it through. So there's a great, marvelous price to pay, but a great payoff. Well, our time is, I guess our time is gone. I get rolling down this train track and get too enthused. If any of you... Any of you? Okay, let's stop and ask if there's any questions. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, allowing ourselves, you know, to not be so hard on ourselves. So yeah, maybe I am motivated too much by fear. But I know that I can, you know, move ahead and progress and stuff like that. So that's what I think. I think we all can.
Well, I think that too. What's the motive to stop this? It feels so bad, and we feel so trapped, and we don't feel we can. We think sometimes we've tried everything with our kids, and what we've tried is the same thing with minor variation 1,000 times, but we haven't tried everything. We don't know how to do these trust-building skills. But what all of us want in our heart of hearts is this, and the funnest book I ever wrote was this book called The Ways and Power of Love. It kind of has a kind of a gentleness about it, and part of it is a gentleness with ourselves. If we made a mistake, gosh, I used to beat up on myself when I'd make mistakes. I don't anymore. And I'm just not in the least bit attracted to the old perfectionist idea. I found out how obsessive and compulsive that was and how harmful it was to me. Any other questions or comments? Yes.
Why do you think the church as an institution does not encourage more bishops to engage in personal counseling instruction such that you've been giving to bishops in this area? Is it a matter of money, or is it a matter of ideology?
No, it's not money, and it's not, in my opinion, it's not ideology either. I think it's a matter of not knowing that it's available. I think something that I believe is that by and large, people are doing the best they know how. And when people make a mistake, the enemy, he makes her the enemy, and she makes him the enemy, or the parents make the kids the enemy, or it's easy to make the church the enemy. But all that, in my opinion, is incorrect. I think the real enemy is ignorance. We don't know how to do it better. And if we knew how to do it better, we'd do it better. So I think this is something that's going to come. I think it's going to come more from the grassroots, but I think this is going something to come. And I'm not blaming anybody. I'm saying we just need to learn how to do it better. When I was in the Sunday School General Board, they made me chairman of the Gospel Doctrine Committee, and I said, we don't study the most important thing that needs to be studied. And they said to me, what's that? And I said, we don't really make a serious study of love. Because love, in order to be here, you have to become quite disciplined. Love requires lots of discipline. You can't move from fear, anxiety to love, trust without learning the disciplines of being there and showing up and so on. And they said, well, the church isn't ready for that. Write us a manual that says, and I wrote a second manual called Taking Control of Your Life. And then the church at that point was just switching over to a four-year cycle of study through the scriptures, and so they didn't use it as a little manual. And I quickly wrote a manual on the Doctrine and Covenants, which in part is still being used. But I was disappointed because I think we need to make a serious study of love and how to practice love. I really deeply believe that.
How would you counsel a teenager who feels she's a perfectionist and is compelled, it's almost beyond her, and she is good at pleasing others?
I wish we had time to role play this with you, but let me just kind of give you a quick walkthrough. Let's say I'm her mother or her father, and here the daughter. I say, need to have a serious talk with you. Is that okay? What would she say? There's something happening that's bothering me, and I need to be straight, but I need to talk to you adult to adult. Could we do that? Okay. There's the kind of a notion developing. It feels in you that if you're not perfect, you're not good enough. Would you say that's evolving, or isn't that true for you? Yeah. Does that mean that no matter how good you do anything, it isn't good enough? She'd say yes. So that means there's always someone prettier. There's always someone smarter. There's always someone who can do things that you can't do. So I can kind of wonder, let's talk a little bit about, are you condemning yourself to being a second-rate person? And what would she say? You see, these questions these are valuing questions. These are asking her the question of what she's producing in the long run. Now, wouldn't it be interesting if we could do that with her, and we'd need 2 or 3 hours to do that, or maybe even longer. But you see, she needs to face what her perfectionism is producing, and it's an endless life of unhappiness. And if she begins to see that for herself, then she's going to want something different. Okay?
Any other questions?
I just have a comment. She might be interested in this. The church is putting lots of money into therapy right now. They're dumping tons of money into it, and it's not so much.
A little louder, please.
The church isn't necessarily just, you know, getting their own staff, but they are paying for many members of the church to get counseling. They're sending them to therapists. Mostly, a lot of them.
Yes, the church has everywhere. There's a big center. The church has a Department of Social Services, and I've worked extensively with several of them, and it's been fun work to do. I'm not saying it covers the need, and it can't begin to cover the need. The fact of the matter is, in a recent study done on the East Coast, about between 5 and 6% of the entire population is so mentally ill that they need professional help. Now, in a ward of 600, if 5% of them need that help, where are they going to get that help? And I'm talking about professional help. I'm talking about psychoses or neuroses, and they're probably not going to get that kind of help. I think the church is doing what they can with it, but I think the church could do a lot more than what they're doing with it. And I think that's coming someday. I think a lot of these things have to take time to evolve or to develop or whatever the right word is. Other comments? Yes.
In the celestial type person, doesn't it have to be some level of fear or wanting to protect oneself?
Boy, that's a great big giant question. I think this is something that we have to grow into. I think it looks, for me, it looks something like this. And as we learn how to do it, we move upward. As we learn how to find bedrock, we learn how to move forward. And sometime we cross over that line and actually become motivated essentially by love and trust. And if fear develops, and it does develop, what the love trust person does is acknowledges it. For instance, if you're my friend, John, and we're kind of at the love trust level, and a conflict develops between us in a kind of a strong and yet gentle way, and that's possible to be strong and gentle, I might say to you, I'm feeling like things aren't going very well for us right now, and I'm feeling like maybe you don't think they're going very well, and it's not going to end very well, and I would like to acknowledge that and talk it through and see if we can both feel better about it. So the fear is there, but instead of the fear being hidden, swept under the rug or piled higher in the closet, we deal with it honestly and directly. And I think we can do that, and I think love trust people know how to do that.